Hello and welcome to The Slow Revolution, the podcast where we explore the pros and cons of slowing down in a fast and impatient world. I'm Carl Honoré, your host, and my guest today is Mike Grenier, a housemaster at Eton College in England, teacher of English, and a co-founder of the Slow Education Movement. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl.
Let's start off by defining our terms, because people will be hearing this and thinking, what on earth does slow education mean? So what does it mean to you?
So slow education is about engaging with students in a manner which is deep and meaningful to them, that takes time to see them understand difficult concepts and develop strong and ethical relationships between the teacher, the student and the subject matter, and also, I think, a student's schooling and the environment in which they live.
And the common theme there seems to be taking time. All of the elements you mentioned there, you cannot be rushed, presumably that's...
Absolutely. As a teacher, one of the things that you learn, I think, through experience is the idea that in the classroom itself, tempo is quite important. There are some things that some students pick up quickly. There are other things which require a more reflective and sort of ruminative approach. So one of the things in slow education is making sure that the tempo and the pace at which you're trying to engage students is varying depending on perhaps their own potential, their own ability, their own prior knowledge, and ensuring that throughout this whole process that schools take time, ensure that they have control over time rather than finding themselves and therefore also their students the sort of victims of time, which I think is sort of a big issue. For young people in particular, I think if they're pushed through things too fast, too young, they don't pick them up, they become demotivated, and then it becomes very difficult to get them back into the place that they need to be in order to learn.
And the fact that you've put your weight behind this slow education movement must suggest that a lot of kids are not getting that, whether in your own school, Eton, or in the state sector, or just across the board, presumably.
Yeah, I think if you talk to most teachers around the world, most countries are engaging with the idea of how do we simplify education systems to ensure that they can be standardized and results driven. The problem with that is that it creates this sort of extraordinary sort of global competition, which I don't think anyone really signed up to. And what then happens is that through each school and in each classroom, there's a real problem with taking time, allowing creative acts of thinking to be at the core of what it is that you're trying to do in a school. So I think what has happened as well is that as governments and schools have become more worried about results and standardizing, and as in a sense we've come to know more about the world, there's this sort of desperate desire to sort of shoehorn it all in and cram it in. And the last time I looked, the number of hours in a day were the same. And what then inevitably happens is that you try and accelerate things in a manner which is counterproductive. And I think every school, doesn't matter where they are in the world, is struggling with this idea of how do we fit in the amount that we're expected to cover in the time available. And I think one of the things that slow education tries to do is say, don't even start with that ambition, because that's flawed. You're never going to be able to do it. What you have to do is you have to be very careful at selecting what it is that you think is of value to students, but also recognize that what you're trying to do is keep them in love with learning, that they can then do it on their own, away from the classroom, away from school, and make it part of their whole lives.
You mentioned in passing there the international competition, and of course the PISA results have become a stick with which to beat one's foes in the political arena, and it's become a kind of source of terror, really, hasn't it, for educators and politicians alike. Would you, if you could wave a magic wand, would you simply remove those international comparisons using standardized testings, or would you replace them with something different?
Well, the difficulty with someone like the OECD is that, you know, they're set up via the PISA tests to measure things which are of significance in a global economy, where governments are investing huge amounts of taxpayers' resources. Of course, there has to be a certain degree of accountability. The problem is they're very narrow, and the data that they use is open to quite a lot of questioning. And what then happens is that because politicians are being briefed, you know, to deal with sound bites and to try and understand things fairly quickly in order to get that rapid communication out there for the public, is that actually what PISA is measuring suddenly sort of ends up having a life of its own. And the reality is that most schools recognize that what PISA measures is important, but is not the be-all and end-all. And I know that the OECD is introducing sort of new matrices, new ways of measuring other aspects of sort of non-cognitive learning about character skills or ability to collaborate in the workplace. But even then, the problem is that you end up sort of killing it by measuring it, sort of we murder to dissect, sort of Wordsworth said. And I think you have to be very careful with data, because we know that some of the high-performing areas, say, for example, Shanghai, the students that they get to be part of the PISA group assessment are in many cases selected. It's not a fair comparison between one area and another. We also know that a number of countries and areas, say, if I think of, say, Singapore and South Korea, where their performance has been very high, but it's come at a cost. They've realised that in order to sort of chase the PISA numbers, you then have to deal with the fallout, which is often sort of in human terms about stress levels, anxiety, mental health issues, and also about the sort of holistic sense in which your next generation of children are being prepared to be contributors to society at large. So those sort of authorities or those countries have stepped back a little bit and said, this is not actually what we want. You know, we've chased it, we've won it, but as ever, having won the prize actually rather missed the point of education per se. So I think PISA is it has a meaning, but it can't be the be all and end all.
Hasn't China come round to, or starting to come round to this form of thinking that they're losing creativity? Haven't they measured creativity in China and found that they're actually very low down the scale, even though they score high on that those narrow bands of PISA achievement?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the emerging economies sort of go through a narrative, which is sort of partly to mimic currently established economies and to make sure that they, to a certain degree, can sort of beat them on what they perceive as sort of one measure of success, which might be output. But for economies like China and other countries, I think, say, for example, Finland, yeah, the narrative of their education system is now going through second, third, fourth generation, where they're reviewing it, reflecting on it, seeing the gains that they've made, but recognizing that as the global economy is shifting and changing and as society is developing in quite a rapid way in the modern age, that it's just not enough. That in societies which were once obviously driven, say in China, by a sort of form of an industrial revolution, they're now aware that they need this sort of second or third generation in their workforce who are creative, collaborative, entrepreneurial. And of course, a lot of the didactic nature of their system rather sort of crushes out of them that spirit of creativity, that willingness to take risks. So I think they've begun to realise that in the sort of next iteration of their education system needs to sort of correlate more successfully with what it is as an economy, as a nation they're seeking. So I think that's certainly one of the reasons. One of the other narratives I think that is important, say for example in China as well, has been the byproduct of the limits placed on children, the family sizes. So what has happened is that in a family where the number of children is limited to one, that one individual child becomes this sort of extraordinary focus for two or three generations. And the grandparental and the parental generation expect a huge amount of that one individual. And by limiting family sizes, which they've done for a number of reasons which are possibly understandable, what then happens is those generations of children are under such intense scrutiny that they can't actually learn. They're not learning properly. They're simply sort of being stuffed like a foie gras group goose in France. and they're unhealthy. So I think there are all sorts of ways in which countries are reviewing the internal impact, the social impact of their policies in education, as well as recognising, in a sense, the sort of the external impact in terms of their economies. And I think China and India, Singapore, South Korea, you know, those are all nation states that have looked very, very carefully now at the way in which they've been producing children through an education system and realising to a certain degree that the product isn't good enough.
It's always invidious to compare across borders, but let me ask you if there's a country or a group of countries that we should all be looking to learn lessons from. You mentioned Finland. They're often held up as an example of slow education or education with a slow vibe to it. Where would you point the finger for?
I think almost every country has an interesting diversity of educational provision. There are many countries that have quite a lot of private provision. I think about the variety of different styles of learning between, say, the Montessori schools and the Waldorf Steiner schools, schools which have different ethoses in certain countries. So when I look globally, I come back to the understanding that there's a lot of it going on in the UK. For a start, we don't need to travel around the world, however nice it is. And I know there are many head teachers and educationists who engage very successfully in the global market and have picked up interesting strategies and pedagogies around the world. But the reality is quite a lot of it is happening in the UK. I've traveled around the United Kingdom. I've recognized really innovative and exciting practices going on all over the country, whether it's in state-funded schools, private schools, free schools. I think the interesting areas sort of globally are the educational systems where people listen to one another well, where they're regularly gathering to discuss the things that seem to really matter most to teachers and to parents and to school children. So any country where there is a very open dialogue and debate about how do we keep this balance between human flourishing and economic viability, that any country which is involved engaging in that in an interesting way, I think, is exciting. So I think countries like New Zealand and Australia, where they are in the sort of global economy and in terms of their own development as nations, I think there's some very, very interesting practice there. I know that in Canada as well, that there's some very interesting conversations going on in British Columbia, for example, looking very, very carefully at what it is they're preparing their children for on the West Coast. But I think it is around a lot. And I think what happens that now, because of things like TED Talks, because of the RSA and the Imagine, sort of animation sort of lectures, iTunes U, you only have to look at the impact of multimedia to see that educational debate has become a really sort of significant part of the internet. And so people are looking around, they're looking very carefully at it, reviewing it, and returning in some cases to some of the great thinkers about education. One of the key books I've read recently is by a man called Martin Robinson, who's looked back at the great sort of medieval Western tradition of the trivium and looking at the ideas of grammar and logic and rhetoric and recognizing that those still sort of underpin a modern education. So I think what's happened partly as a reaction to governments that are very keen to over administrate education systems is that people are now sort of rebelling against it in quite a sort of polite way. And I think that's been interesting as well, is that the history of education and the culture of education has come back into public discourse and public conversation.
One thing I noticed, though, is that when reformers arrive in the public sphere with a rallying cry, it's often to move away from making education do what politicians think it should do and doing what business and industry thinks it should do. And I wonder if there's a danger that we replace one set of biases with another.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think everyone has their own agenda. And in many ways, the agenda, say, of a politician is often determined by their length of service, whether they're in opposition or whether they're in government. So I think one of the things that I would view very strongly as being important in any healthy education system is a slow approach to policy making, which is measured. It's not about quick fixes. It's about taking time to review and reflect upon well-conducted research, listening to expertise, and ensuring that there's a proper sort of dialogue going on between the people who care most about society. So when I listen to the conversations that are going on, it strikes me that there are many voices that are saying the same thing who don't often meet, and that there might be structurally, say, for example, in the United Kingdom, a problem in a fragmented education system which in some ways sort of stands against the idea of collaboration and sharing best practice. So one side for a while can get quite a lot of hearing. But in reality, I think what sees the greatest improvement in a system is careful, deliberate thinking, which is managed across various sectors. And I think that, you I guess, would know this as much as anyone else, that slow fixing a complex system is the best way of going about it. And I don't think there is a system that is more complex in a society than its education system.
That's certainly the case. And when you look at Britain or, many countries with that democratic system where every 4 years you get a new government coming in and often they want to make an imprint and a splash, and it's education they turn to. So you end up with that scenario with the pendulum swinging back and forth. I think in Finland they're a bit more, they take a longer view, don't they? Where it's almost, not that education's insulated from politics, but there's a continuity there in that dialogue you referred to earlier where they don't come in with quick fixes. One minister, then another minister 6 months later. There's much more continuity. I wonder if we can get to something like that in our systems where it seems to be much more yabu and bash, bashing the backstabbing colleagues and carousel of different ministers swiveling around every year.
Well, I think there is an issue about time frames. I think the most stable education systems are the ones which have solid foundations and have perhaps what you might call like a length of service issue, by which I mean they see that as a virtue. I think the world of modern business and the models of politics are very much about quick turnover, being light on your feet, working out your place in the market. Now, education systems and people who work in schools don't necessarily always adhere to that. The view in many schools is that one of the things that often is the key feature and the characteristics of a successful school is that a certain degree of its staff are stable and have a long-term investment personally in that institution. So we've gone through a period of flux in terms of our attitude towards stability and some of those virtues of long-term service. So the political establishment doesn't necessarily adhere to them. And in many cases, the modern world of entrepreneurialism and the talks of modern technology, anyone involved in futurology will often be talking about, we don't know what's going to happen next week, let alone next year. And I think education systems work on a slightly different set of sort of biorhythms. Mm-hmm. And I think if the education systems are allowed to evolve, according to that more sort of natural set of rhythms, then usually what you see is a careful evolution and a careful adoption of new methods of still approaching the same qualities, students being curious, open-minded. Doesn't matter whether it's a book or whether it's pen or paper, whether it's orally or whether it's on an iPad or whether it's using sort of broadband or the latest thing on their Apple Watch. The reality is the core values and virtues of education have barely changed. What's happened is the tools surrounding them have changed. But in all essence, I think that the healthiest education systems are the ones that recognise values and virtues and an ethical position at the heart of them. And realise that if you stick to them but work out ways of modernising them, that slow evolution is the healthiest way of doing it. I mean, there aren't many education systems that need completely tearing up and throwing out the window in the developed world. What they usually need is some very, very careful realignment over a number of years.
Did you yourself have an aha moment in the classroom when you suddenly thought, we've lost our compass here, we've lost our bearings, something needs to change, either in my school, Eton, or in the schooling systems around them?
I think whenever a question comes at you from a student of, is this on the syllabus, that's one of the moments where a little red light flashes in your head. It might be that one of your students has asked a question which is interesting and slightly off-piste. It may well be a red herring to take you off track, mm-hmm. which is, of course, one of the student's great skills. But in reality, I think some of the aha moments, the red light bulb moments of warning flashed at me when I had this sort of beginning to get this relentless questioning about mark schemes, about assessment, about the purpose of the lesson, about whether or not this was going to be assessed at the end of it. And it made me fear for what it was that was going on. I wondered whether or not what I thought was happening in my lessons, what the students were expecting to happen to them, had suddenly sort of gone shunted like trains on different points down completely different tracks. And I think I hear this from a huge number of students in particular. I think you talk to a lot of students who are going through the system, and a lot of them really admire the teachers who are prepared to take a stand, press the pause button and say, okay, for a minute, let's go off-piste. And they're sometimes very frustrated because they have interesting questions to ask. But they themselves get the red light bulb flashing above their heads when the teacher says, sorry, we haven't got time for that because we've got to stick to the syllabus. And I think that was probably the moment where I felt, hang on, this really is not, I think, what I see as the vocation of being in education, which is to stimulate curiosity and open thinking, as well as deliver knowledge and get people, you know, assessed well to make sure that in standardized tests they're not, you know, shutting down any options in later life. I don't think any teacher wants to do that. But it seemed to me about 10 years ago, so just around about sort of into the new start of the new millennium, particularly in England, it became almost obsessive, and they introduced new examinations and standardized tests at the age of 17, in sort of year 12. There were more standardized tests earlier on. And I began to become aware that what was happening really was that teachers were effectively processing exams, processing students through assessments, ensuring efficiency over quality.
And did you feel your own self being pushed in that direction?
Absolutely. And I would often ask myself, have I got enough time to cover this material? And over the years, what has happened in the English system is that the amount of material to cover in the curriculum has grown and grown and grown, because there's great fear that if you don't fill the curriculum up with material, no teacher will do anything at all, and no kid will learn anything at all, and we've got to make sure it's all there. So it gets filled up with stuff. And what I found myself then doing is worrying so much about whether I was getting through the stuff enough. And I think as a teacher, that does get in the way of what you might call like the craft of the classroom, because what you then become worried about is making sure that you're delivering and you're getting through things with efficiency rather than ensuring a quality of experience and an engagement and the depth of knowledge and understanding. So it was those are the biggest issues that I think I confront. And because I work in a boarding school, I do have certain more control of my time outside the classroom. And I'm also very privileged, obviously, working in a private school, which has more freedoms, and also it's a selective school. So you add all those things up, and which is why I very rarely want to sort of say that my experience is in any way typical of a teacher's. But I can only speak about what I know. And I know that at a school like Eton, with its tradition of free thinking and its traditions of independent research and a sort of progressive attitude towards the democratic liberal arts tradition, that there's a real tension going on. The mainstream has come into our world. It has some benefits, but it equally has sort of come in and displaced or put pressure on some of the things that we consider to be important to our own culture.
And have done for 1,000 years, I suppose.
Well, it's over hundreds of years, you know, back to this idea of the sort of the slow evolution of systems. You know, Eton College has a long tradition of free thinkers, Shelley, George Orwell, people who've come into it, partly because it's an institution as a part of, you know, the what one might call the sort of the great old-fashioned hierarchies of the English, you know, establishment. And so people going into that were able to fight against it because it was such an establishment place. And then what happened in the 20th century is I think it approached education with a much more free-thinking, spirited approach through the certainly through the 50s, 60s and 70s, and it's through the 1970s and 80s, I think the school recognised that it did have, you know, an intellectual and an academic tradition to uphold and a character that was very, very clear. And that's the time when it was, in many ways, working in its most interesting progressive ways. And it was in the late 80s that things then shifted and changed. And what you ended up with was the interventions of large-scale government policies, which were never considered in the past to be part of the remit of a school like Eton. So that's the challenge for Eton, is how does it become true to itself and its own values while also being part of a mainstream?
How, within the hallowed halls of Eton, is your adherence to this slow education movement going down? Are you seen as a lone wolf? Are you reflecting other people's views? How is it all playing out at?
Well, I think the interesting aspect, say, for example, about working at a boarding school is that what some people might call the hidden curriculum. So the things that are not necessarily assessed, that are not part of a standardized model of examination, are so much part of the culture. If you've got the students with you from 7:30 in the morning until 11:30 at night, you know, you could try and teach them for all that time, but I think it would be counterproductive. And of course, parents are buying into the concept of boarding school life Not because in the old-fashioned way they want to pack their kids off and not see them again, or because of their requirements to work for, say, the armed forces or in the colonial service. The reality is a lot of parents make a decision to send their children to boarding school because boarding school life offers a sort of holistic vision of education. It offers hours and hours and hours of different experiences. So slowness, in terms of being sort of deliberate, deep, and purposeful, is being exhibited all the time around the school like Eton and any boarding school. State boarding schools would be exactly the same. And in many day schools as well. It's through music, it's through art, it's through drama, it's through community service, whether you're in the combined cadet force. So many of my colleagues, are absolutely sort of aligned to the concepts of slowness in terms of that depth of engagement, because that's why they chose to work in a boarding school, because they like to do the basics, but they like the extra, or they recognize that the relationship between them and a student is much deeper than purely in terms of the transference of knowledge and its assessment in a classroom. So there is a lot of slowness, metaphorical slowness at Eton. It is difficult because we're a high-performing school, and because there is an expectation on us as teachers and on our students that we should seek academic excellence and see our children perform the very best that they can within this national exam structure. So there are times, I think, that slowness either has to be put on the back burner, or is engaging in a sort of Manichaean struggle with the current nature of the education system. And we need to be aware as well that a lot of parents are considering Eton not just for the holistic education, but because they see it as a passport to a successful career as well as a sort of successful curriculum vitae. So it's making sure that you keep that balance going, and making sure that wherever possible you win the argument, which is that slowness leads to better performance, to better mental health, towards a better understanding of who you are as a person, and that all of those things will then have a positive impact on results, and that it's not a sense that it's either or. The two are so carefully interlinked and interconnected.
Do you feel you're winning that argument with the, well, it sounds like you may have already won it with the colleagues at Eton, but with the parents and the students?
I think you have the argument, you have the proper debate, you make sure that you remain sensitive to the fact that you can't just sort of rather sort of monolithically sort of throw this idea down at people and accept, and expect them to sort of accept it without it coming under some form of decent criticism. I think slowness as a word and as a metaphor in the educational establishment is quite pejorative. So you have to, first of all, spend quite a lot of time defining it and refining it in the parents' minds. There are some parents who, perhaps because of their own education or their own culture in which they've been brought up or their own experience of education, would see slowness as a sort of dangerous approach to their children's lives. So I think you have to be very sensitive about it. It's not necessarily something that people take too terribly easily. I think I'm not going to kid myself into believing that we're going to win over the hearts and minds of everyone. But I've had a huge amount of support from the parents of the families in my house whenever we've discussed these ideas. I think across the culture of the school, there's much more interest in holistic education. And I think generally, if you say to people, this is about quality, then I think you can win the argument with those sorts of people who are open to the debate and discussion.
How has it changed on the ground for you? How do your classes look different today? How do you teach differently today than you did, say, 10, 15 years ago or 5 years ago?
Okay, some of the things I like to try and embed in my practice, just in terms of the day-to-day teaching. So I teach English literature quite a lot, although I do teach English language. But say in English literature, if I'm teaching my students a set text, I'm very keen that they read it first for pleasure. I'm absolutely committed to the idea that the first engagement between a student and a work of literature should be as close to as the writer intended. It needs to be there as a work of sort of entertainment to sort of hold the mind of the reader by the narrative and maybe by the ideas. And I know that there are plenty of resource packs out there. I know that there are online resources for pretty much everything. You can sign up to Schmoop, and you can sign up to study guides, and you can pick all that material. But I think there's a real problem with that, because I think that is getting in the way of the intensity of experience that you want students to have with a set text.
It's a shortcut as well, isn't it, often?
Yeah, and you're denying them the opportunity to enjoy the text. You know that by the end of the year, in many cases, particularly in a subject like English, which is a sort of core requirement, that they may well not enjoy the text. And every teacher has to confront that, that to expect everyone to enjoy what you're putting in front of them, you know, may well be slightly deluded or naive. But you've got to try everything you can possibly to ensure that there is that intensity and an integrity of relationship. So that's certainly one of the things that I'm avoiding at the moment, as I'm avoiding a strong pre-reading or a strong mid-reading sort of online presence or giving out significant amounts of resources early on. I think one of the other things that's affected my practice has been in the classroom setting. I think the way your room is set up is important. I've always believed in having open spaces and mobile desks. You need to have sort of like Lego blocks around your room. So there are times when it can be one large rectangular table, other times break it into small groups. There are times when you want them together if you're going to do a sort of large plenary. You need space to move in. So when I'm teaching drama, it's nice to get the students up on their feet. But even with teaching poetry, you're bringing poetry, narrative poetry, ballads to life. So there are ways of getting that intensity of experience that I think, you know, I've thought quite hard about in terms of the layout of your classroom. I think the other thing in recent years that has really made a difference as well is engaging students in feedback. I feel that, you know, obviously my vocation has led me into the classroom in order to do the best I can for students. But I'm not really going to know that unless I'm going to delude myself into thinking that what I see in front of me is what's really going on. And a colleague of me told me a great issue of this when we started doing student questionnaires and feedback, that the person who he felt was most bright-eyed, smiled the most, and was most sort of visually engaged in the classes was the one who wrote on the questionnaire, "I find most of this so boring." People are very, very good. Students are experts at appearing interested and engaged. And I thought, I've got to find out, in reality, whether it's going as well as I think it is. And also get the feedback that I need to improve my teaching almost, not minute by minute, but certainly within a few weeks. And this is an idea that came out of the thinking of W. Edwards Deming, which is that when he was a professor, I think a professor of statistics, he would see the job of him marking his students' papers as an opportunity, as like a sounding wall for the return back to him be where he, as a teacher, may have failed in communicating an idea clearly enough, rather than it being a sort of red ink moment for him to say, "Yeah, this is rubbish, you've not learned a thing." Mm. And I think that sort of humility I picked up from him, I think, is crucial to slow education, which is that the intensity of the relationship, the human relationship between teacher and student, is absolutely core. And the more you can do to give it strength and sort of an ethical dimension, and as well as an integrity, you know, the impact on you as a teacher is going to be enormous. But the impact on young people is also enormous, because they look up to teachers and they look up to the adult world. And if the adult world gives them the right signals, then I think you're involving them in the conversation of the generations. So I found that getting student feedback and asking open questions about how they're getting on with things has allowed me to refine my teaching to make it sort of more bespoke. And the impact of that has been enormous. And the last little tweak I think I've done over the last few years in terms of actually slowness. Teachers ask a lot of questions, and at a school like Eton, we very much sort of belong to the Socratic tradition, the idea that sort of in the group, ideas are thrown out, they're debated, there's discussion, rhetoric is there at its finest. You refine, you review, but it plays quite a lot into the hands of extrovert performers, and the world's got plenty of them. But as Susan Cain wrote, there are lots of introverts, lots of quiet people. And there are lots of people who need the time and the space to reflect and ruminate. And I became very aware that quite a lot of the snappy Q&A bit that you can get in a classroom is very shallow. It may well exclude a good proportion of your students, because that's just not the way they happily and confidently operate. So I now do things like I put like a 5-minute warning on a question. I say nobody's to answer this question for 5 minutes.
Really?
And I say to them, the reason why is it's difficult, and I don't want you just throwing out a sort of snappy, you know, clever answer at me, because I don't think it's possible. And that's been great. It's really nice as well. And when relatively inexperienced teachers come into the classroom, they look at it and they say, God, it must take so much confidence to do that. Because I think a lot of teacher training and a lot of pedagogical styles are about filling every minute and making sure that from minute one to minute 40, your lesson plan is sort of timetabled by the second, like it's a sort of like the radio program. It just doesn't work like that. So that was one of the other things that's made a big difference in the last few years. Difficult questions, take time, enjoy silence. Silence in a classroom sometimes is absolutely brilliant.
I was just going to say, what happens in those 5 minutes? Is it 5 minutes of silent rumination by the pupils, or are they, they're just left to ponder the question before opening their mouths?
Yeah, and you would say to them, in those 5 minutes, I want you to think carefully about it. I want you to think about a number of different arguments. Mm-hmm. You could, for example, ask them during that period to say, put in their notes, or consider some ways, you know, a dialectic that could be going on from that question. You know, just consider both sides of this argument. You can divide your own classroom into two. I mean, if it's a really interesting sort of knotty topic, which does have a real sense of ambiguity and a dilemma to it, you know, you can say, team on the left, that, you know, I want you to approach from that side, team on the right from that side, but don't talk. Part of the reason for this is to ensure that proper thinking gets done. One of the other things as well is that group work and class group work can very easily just turn into a sort of free-for-all. And there's not much takeaway from it. You know, when you ask boys in my classroom to show me notes, I often wonder actually how much they've taken down from it, because there's a lot of chat, there's a lot of stuff in mid-air. Mm. And when it comes to the end of the day, in a few months' time, you'd say to them, do you remember that discussion we had about that topic? And they've not got materials down. And I talk to people who are professors at universities who find that their students are sitting very passively in a lecture theatre because they're expecting handouts, or they want the PowerPoint presentation online, or they're going to see it on a TED talk, and they, you know, so it's all there for them, prepackaged. And I think there's a danger there that you disengage them from the thinking process and the active listening that's so important for learning. So by slowing it down and by keeping it more deep and quiet and reflective, you ensure that there is something much more profound going on. You're also preparing them to listen well in later life, which I think is an important thing. I think the final thing that matters a lot in that particular thing is about behaviour. Because I've been in many classrooms where sort of group work's been going on, but the teacher, in trying to get around all the different tables, you know, turns their back on one area. And actually then what goes on in that little group that knows it's sort of out of the teacher's gaze is pretty useless. I mean, there's not much going on. And then you get this idea that sometimes the sign of a happy class is a noisy class. Well, there are times when a noisy classroom is great, and we don't want everyone being quiet the whole time. But it's just about balance, and it's about the right thing. So I do like classrooms where there is a nice sense of chatter. But I also think silence and deep thinking is also important. And it's important for everyone. This is not just for the intellectually elite. I think everyone needs to have silence in the classroom as well.
Well, silence and deep thinking is something we all need, not just in the classroom, right? I need more of. Since you brought the 5-minute warning into effect, have you noticed kids who are less the extrovert, shoot from the hip style coming into the conversations more and taking more of a role?
Yeah, so I think what you can then do is at the end of those 5 minutes, you can ask two or three neighbours next to one another to share their ideas. So that immediately puts the quieter guy on the same level playing field as the more extrovert. And you can then just make sure that you remember, in a sense, in your head, how often you've asked the more self-confident individual to feed back to the group and how often you've asked the introvert. So in a sense, what you're doing is you're scaffolding the introvert to just give them the opportunity to come up with ideas, some of which are their own, some of which are other people's. Because a lot of introverts are brilliant listeners, really brilliant listeners. They write fantastic notes. They understand what's going on perfectly. And the number of sort of end-of-term reports you get, you know, he hasn't said much in my lessons, and I wish he was more engaged. And you see on the top line, 96% top out of 20. And you think, okay, don't ask for too much. Mm-hmm. You know, get it right. So it is about balance. It's about making sure that, I guess it's back to that idea of tempo, that there are times in a classroom when it needs to be andante, where you need to go at that sort of pace. And then for some children, that is the right way of doing it. And in that experience of changing their tempo, I think, you know, that everyone benefits from it. And I think a bit like I suppose the analogy, someone like Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow, is that we have a number of different ways of processing things in our brains. And we can be very quick and intuitive. And I think there are some times when that's fantastic. And I wouldn't want to say that the actual change of tempo is just simply about moving it to slower. Yeah, there are wonderful times when picking up the pace in a classroom can be really, really effective as well. Because I think human beings need to respond to different paces and understand that there are times when they might be put on the spot and they need to be able to come to a quick decision. And that's not just, you know, like as a lifeguard or when they're having to do first aid. I mean, I think there are times as a thinker where you need to suddenly put on your ABC hat. How am I going to get this done? So, I think tempo is such an important thing in school life.
Well, in a way, that's a kind of slow in a nutshell, isn't it? The idea of shifting gears and changing tempos and sometimes fast and sometimes slow. I mean, that's not just education, is it? That's what applies to food, sex, travel, design, whatever people are doing. So slow education fits very comfortably into that whole culture quake. I wonder now, just looking back, if you are hearing less from your pupils that question of, is this on the syllabus? Will this be assessed? Are you hearing those red light questions less than you did before?
Well, I think it does depend very strongly on the system in which you are existing. So we are, I mean, in the UK, in England in particular, we're going through a time of great change in terms of the curriculum and in terms of the assessment. And from my point of view and from a position, of the Eden College has, removing examinations from a couple of the years in which they're under our care is a good thing. We're losing examinations at the end of year 10, so when the students are about 15, they're not able to take exams in bite-sized chunks and retake them. So for us, that's fantastic. Similarly, at the lower sixth end, so when they're 17, again, there's a return to sort of linear examination, so they enter into two-year courses. So for us, that's good. And I'm not saying one size fits all. I know for a lot of schools, they're unhappy with these changes, and it does, you know, weigh against students from certain backgrounds and with certain resources. What it does give us, though, is much more freedom. So over the course of a couple of years, you know, you've got a lot more time to say to the students, this is about building foundations, because there's not that need to say, and of course in June when you sit the examination, you know, that's what you need to do. So I think for us, the structural changes to the English system, you know, are a benefit. I think every teacher tries to explain at some point early on in the academic year what their values are, what they expect. They try and go through, you know, the basics of housekeeping rules, if you want. You know, those are that and reading out the Riot Act are the two sort of great things that teachers, you know, will do. And in the housekeeping rules, I think one of the things that I do more and more of is that I explain to boys that if they understand the process that we're going through and its benefits, then they won't need to ask the question of why are we doing this. And I think that's important. I think teachers need to explain their strategy. I think they need to explain to students exactly how the learning is going to be conducted so that there's no confusion and that there's no clash of expectations. So I found that with that and the questionnaires, I find that more often than not, students are absolutely clear, you know, that that's the way it will be with me. And I think one of the key skills you learn in school life as well as a teenager in particular is like that idea of code switching. You know, in so-and-so's class, this is what you do. You know, in so-and-so's class, this is what you don't do. If he marks out of 25, you're never going to get more than 19. And once somebody got 20 and it was like the whole place fainted. So-and-so loves that. Someone else doesn't like this. I think that's really, really crucial. So if some of my colleagues don't necessarily buy into some of my strategies, it doesn't really bother me, because I think you need teenagers at school to understand that they're going to be different people with slightly different expectations, different rules, but who still have high standards. That's where it's all, you know, that's where the common ground is. So I think, you know, by and large, students are pretty happy with it. But it does take some quite careful explanation. And you need to try and explore with them the benefits of this different approach. And that can often be done, I think, by exploring ideas which are sort of, in a sense, quite emotional, quite affective issues in a student's life. If you talk to them about the times when they're stressed, if you talk to them about their anxieties as a student, if you talk to them about their fears, you can find out that quite a lot of them are down to an early childhood, which has been very seriously affected by people who are results-driven and only interested in the grade. And if you explain to students and teenagers that in order to moderate some of their feelings and some of their attitudes towards learning, they might need to reflect on these emotional issues, that you suddenly find that nobody really wants to go through a process in which they do feel stressed. And I think this is a big issue for societies at large. If you talk going back to some of the countries on the PISA tables, the reality is that we have too many children growing up with mental health problems in the developed world. And most of those mental health problems, most of them, are, I think, culturally imposed. There's no doubt in my mind that there are people who come with pathology. There are people with pre-existing conditions. There are all sorts of reasons why they may well have mental health issues. But the vast majority of the low-level psychological issues that we have in school about perfectionism, procrastination, anxiety issues over performance,
eating disorders.
But I think, in particular, in what you might call the somewhere academic field, but also performance issues about, am I good enough for this, and will I ever be any good at that? I mean, those all come about from a culture which is always trying to label and give people this very, very narrow sense of achievement. And what you then end up with is, by the time they're 14, 15, 16, which are quite vulnerable times in terms of a teenager's development, they get to that point where they've not got the solid foundations. They've not got the resilience. They've not got the perseverance. They also don't have some of the moral virtues, because they don't necessarily trust the system. And in many ways, the system is slightly dishonest with them. And they learn sometimes that the best way of achieving in this particular system is through a certain form of dishonesty. They get help by their parents in homework. They find ways of sort of cheating their way around the system by buying essays online. So there is an ethical moral issue here, which is about giving them a better mental health. And the other part of that equation is engaging in open sort of communal discussion, which is something you do a lot in the boarding house, whether it's at the dining table or in the corridors, or if you take a group of students out to the theatre, you get lots and lots of hours of chatting. And I think, as a society, one of the key ideas here is about the aspects of human nature which are not about the self. I mean, self-esteem is important, but I think esteem matters. I think how you're judged by your peers and by adults matters a huge amount to children and to teenagers. And I think engaging in those conversations and recognizing that the development of a human character is a slow process, ensures, I think, a much more sort of stable education. But actually, probably in a bigger sense, it ensures a much more stable human being. And I think at the end of the day, people enter the education system to be teachers because they care about people.
A couple of final questions to wrap up. The first is, where do universities fit into the equation? Because getting into, especially the whiz-bang blue-chip college or university, is often the pot of gold at the end of the modern parenting rainbow.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you see universities having a role in reshaping and rethinking priorities in the school sector, how important exams are, extracurriculars, all of that. And do you see changes coming from those big colleges and universities?
Well, in the English system, for high performing children, one of the things that has made a difference is that universities are able to accept more students that have reached a certain threshold in terms of academic achievement. So the ABB threshold means that there are far more students now able to get into the better rated universities than there were before. So there's not like a mad scramble for places in quite the same way as there was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that's taken a bit of a heat out of the system. The issues that I often hear about, say, in the UK from the top performing institutions, so I'd say, Oxford and Cambridge, Imperial College, the sorts of universities which are not only within the British system recognised at the very top, but they have sort of global brand value. I think there are issues there. I think there are pastoral issues. I think there is significant counselling problems that those universities are now confronting, which is they don't have enough support for students who for a long time have been told a tale, which is they're the very best. And by going to a highly selective university, look over their shoulders and suddenly think, but I'm not as good as him and her. And suddenly they go through this crisis of confidence. They're away from home for the first time. And the support networks that they may be used to are just not there. So I think a lot of universities are suddenly becoming aware of the fact that there is a real sort of counselling crisis. And I think the figures aren't great at top performing universities. Dropout rates aren't good either. So I think one of the areas that universities will now have to confront is how do they, in a sense, sort of induct their students slowly through the experience of what it means to be at a high-performing institution. It's a bit like sort of narrowing the gene pool. I mean, what will happen is the more you narrow the types of students that you get, you know, sort of in a sense, the less healthy, you know, the environment will become. So I think that's one of the big things at universities is that they need to spend more time inducting young people. I think a lot of young people going to university have been cosseted from the world. I think they lack quite a lot of the determination required to stand on their own two feet. A lot has been done for them either by schools, and I think, to be honest, a lot of schools can sometimes be, you know, as bad, if not worse, than the snowplow parent or the helicopter parent. I think the cotton wooling from difficulties and failures and mistakes is built through the system and is becoming increasingly a part of sort of modern developed society. The idea that getting something wrong is a part of education and part of life, you know, is increasingly being sort of driven out by this absurd sort of belief that perfection is attainable at almost all times. So I think that I think in university life, I think that's a big issue. So when you have, say, in the American sector, where the material, the data they have on students is much broader, so they're factoring in, you know, the amount of community service maybe or the local action that students have been involved in, as well as SAT scores, as well as. The problem with that is that you end up, again, children living a CV with a very narrow purpose, which is to get into university, rather than necessarily engaging with the experiences for their own sake and then realising that the byproduct of those experiences are that they're successful learners. So I think I'd imagine anyone listening to this in various sort of communities in North America and America, say on the East Coast, would recognise, you know, the sheer panic and the sheer anxiety and the intensity of fear that sort of rushes through the system as it comes to SAT times, as it comes to college essay times, as it comes to making sure that your son or daughter has got the best possible CV behind them in order to get to this place. And it's very hard to know how you change that. How do you dilute that intensity when the world is constantly sending out this message that a university degree is the crucial thing? That is the thing that will make, you know, a significant difference.
Or not just a university degree, but a degree from certain universities.
And a degree from certain universities in certain subjects. Mm. Now, I think what's happening is a bit of a backlash. I think there are some businesses that are working against this and saying that they don't actually trust some of the certification that's going on in national examinations, or even necessarily see in their own right the value of a degree. So I know that there are companies in the UK and the US and around Europe who are developing their own ways, psychometric testing, more interesting interview practice, to say what we're ending up with is a lot of same types of learners and same types of thinkers, and that sort of homogeneity is dangerous because it's not allowing the organisation to be free-thinking and sort of light on its feet. But I think it's difficult. I think universities are sort of caught in the same sort of travelator that secondary schools and primary schools are. While everyone heads up the ladder in effectively the same direction, the fear is that if you're part of that ladder on the chain below, on the rung below, sorry, that you're going to be judged on how many people make it to the next stage. So primary schools and preparatory schools are worried about whether they're getting people into the right secondary schools or the right private schools. And similarly, so many schools are being judged on their results for their movement on elsewhere. And I think what it requires is some very strong leadership from the chancellors of universities. It requires much more communication between the different sectors. To the best of my knowledge, most high-performing universities in the UK have changed their outlook massively in the last 20 years. They are aware that some of them are very privileged and they need to get out and do outreach. But the reality is there's not sufficient communication going on between secondary schools and universities about some of the real issues. And of course, the danger is that they just get worse and worse, and the ignorance of the problems that a lot of teenagers are going through, you know, because it's not known higher up, it's not known when they get to university. You know, the dangers there is that they get lost, and I think that's a much more damaging experience to be lost at university.
To finish off, I imagine that some of our listeners have a couple of questions in their minds at the moment. And the first is probably this, that you're speaking from Eton, which is a very particular kind of school, private school of august traditions, very highly selective pupils in England. But slow education is not just for Etonians, is it? I mean, it's something that can work right across systems up and down the socioeconomic ladder, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, the most important and the most exciting work that's been done in the slow education movement, it's been done in contexts and schools that are completely different to Eton College. There's Matthew Moss High School in Rochdale, which is sort of integrating slow learning principles in its curriculum. It's stripped out some of its sort of official subject-based curriculum time to deal with more experiential learning, project-based learning, but with increasing rigor, getting refined to ensure that thinking skills and knowledge are in some ways sort of combining to provide its students with a really engaging experience. They offer, you know, peer teaching and student-led learning on Saturdays now in the morning, D6, a fantastic project there. For kids, a lot of whom, you know, really are ambitious, they're determined, they want to do well. But in some cases have found that the mainstream or the sort of run-of-the-mill processing through the working week doesn't always give them the freedom to explore things in a way which they find productive. You know, that school is a million miles away from Eton College. But the principles of engagement and the principles of deeper learning are the same. Similarly, some of the primary schools that Slow Education is working with, St. Silas's in Blackburn, you know, here are head teachers and other leaders in that school exploring ways to offer, you know, a diverse student population, many of whom have English as an additional language. They're exploring ways of deeper learning, of engaging with proper project work, of learning the skills of research and thinking. And the context at that point sort of fades away in the face of the engagement and the depth of learning and the enthusiasm of the teachers. So slow education and slow learning is going on all around the world. There are schools that have been in touch with us and we've been in touch with other schools. There are tens of thousands of schools around the world that are doing slow education, but just not saying it. But the reality is that it is a long-standing tradition in many education systems to care deeply about the mastery of subject, the depth of knowledge required to think creatively and imaginatively. So I think, although Eton is a school and a school with particular sort of specialisms, the reality is slowness doesn't really care much denominationally where you come from, what your bricks and mortar look like, what your history is. It's more about the ideas and it's more about putting theory into practice in a way which engages teachers, students, families and communities.
Well, that fills me with optimism, but what about a listener, a teacher, say, who's listening to us now and thinking, yes, I get all of that, I desperately want to do that, but I'm in a school where I'm bombarded by evaluation sheets, I've got a headmaster principal who's a stick in the mud, I've got anxious parents. What are there one or two levers you would suggest that teacher could pull, or tips that just to inject a little bit of slow into their classroom that they could start taking into the school even tomorrow?
Well, it is very, very difficult to do if you don't feel that the culture of the school supports your values and your ideology. And that comes down from governing bodies, it comes from head teachers, it comes from the local community and the students, as well as teachers themselves. So if you're the lone figure out there sort of battling against a system which stands against you, it's a very lonely place. So how do you go about doing it and making sure that you can play the game? I think you have to be politically quite cunning. You need to make sure that you can engage with the world of statistics and data and performance and assessment while also doing a lot of these things in a style, you know, which is true to yourself and your values. And to try then to win the argument, which is to say, my way works. by the way you're judging success, my way works. And I can tell you this, and I can show it to you, because if you want to look at their data, they're improving. If you want to look at the smiles on their faces and the shine in their eyes, have a look at that. If you want to interview the students, ask them how they feel it's going. To parents, if you think this is all sort of wishy-washy, sort of out there and sort of belonging to the to some sort of progressive faddism, you have to say, come into my classroom. Open it up. Prove it. Prove it by experience and prove it by fact and data. And if eventually you don't get anywhere, go to another school. Find the head teachers. Mm-hmm. Find the head teacher.
Because they're out there, aren't
they? Because they are out there. And you can find them pretty quickly because they congregate, they meet, as I said, the internet. You know, the great sort of coffee house of the 21st century. That's where you meet like-minded people. And if you find yourself banging your head against a brick wall and feel that you are betraying your values and you find that what you're offering to your students is something which is diluted and lacking nutrition and disengaging and demoralizing, you don't leave the profession. Yeah, there are too many teachers leaving the profession from him banging their head against a brick wall. Stop banging your head against that brick wall. Go somewhere else. Mm. Find the pastures new.
And in the meantime, maybe play around with a 5-minute warning.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mike. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Carl.